Winston Planning Commission, October 18, 2023.
Now you can't say anything malicious because we're on tape. So y'all had your chance.
And we still got 5 minutes.
Yeah, Cindy will be joining us shortly. She will be helping for the duration of these meetings now.
Cool.
So I'll have to go it alone because you guys outnumber me.
Hasn't done us any good yet. Yeah.
So maybe some introductions, especially for the new gal.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Rob.
Hello.
Nice to meet you. Here you
go. Steve Johnson.
Hi. Cindy. Sorry to be that kind of
thing. I'm Mike. I don't want to reach across people or shake your
hand. Just jump over the table. It's okay. I'm Angelina. So. Nice to meet everyone. Thanks for accepting my
counsel. Yep. Council ratified the application, and so she is bona fide and part of your group now.
A little change of pace from your daily job, huh?
A little bit. Yeah, it's nice to be on the side of the bench.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get to be the judge now.
Yeah. Not worried.
Collectively, yes.
I did just come from a wake up board meeting. So
oh, did
just,
you?
Yeah, to let everyone know that I am on the board of wake up as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we discussed that briefly. There shouldn't be any confliction. They're going to do a building soon, but it doesn't have to come before this body. It's a permitted use in the commercial zone. So down there on. Everyone knows Steve Chinnawork? It's over the Baptist Church down there in Thompson. They got a bunch of area back there. So it may not go through, I don't know, but they're looking at doing their own bit, which is an awesome thing. Get the teen center in there, get the food pantry. The food pantry just moved somewhere else.
So they're going to move the teen center out of the library, huh?
Out of the community center, yeah. They've got a ways to go.
Yeah.
Build that thing, but. Yeah, you're getting inundated with meetings, sounds like. There she is. Quit talking about her.
The IT guy was here, and I was...
Oh, Isaac?
Isaac, yeah. So
we're recording already, so don't say anything bad about him.
We're on the record.
Close enough? All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is October 18th, 2023. We're going to call this meeting to order. Shall we stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Steven, you want to start us out with a roll call?
Steve Johnson.
Rob Price.
Angelina Hollingsworth.
Renee Morgan.
Cynthia Eastburn.
Mike DeRussia.
Thomas McIntosh, staff.
Cindy Sardi, staff.
All right. Comments from the audience.
We can forego that, Madam Chair.
Is this like the first time you had an empty room? I'm just wondering.
We've actually had
a few off and on, haven't we, Liz?
Yeah. Well, council meeting on Monday was packed. So we figured there'd be some carryover. But that's okay.
All right. Well, we will just move on into Community Development Department reports.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thanks for being here this evening. So just a couple of things. We have been working closely with a developer on a property down Southeast Gregory. That is, if you you were to turn out and go down Main Street and turn down Edwards, it's right there over close to the intersection of Edwards and Gregory. There's a proposed multifamily development over there, three triplexes, and we had to require the revisiting of the conceptual plan. There were some few tweaks there. That's going to be a site review. That'll come before this body, probably the November meeting. That is probably the only land use application that we are getting ready to cycle through that will come before you for a hearing. Other than that, our six land use applications have pretty much cycled through. So we're hoping to see more. But nothing yet.
So where do you foresee? About 45 days out then on that one?
Mm-mm.
No.
The application will go out for notice, and we will likely meet the third week of November, although that's a tough week. It tends to be a tough week. So we'll have to go before or after Thanksgiving week, maybe the second week or the fourth week, depending on who's in town. Can we actually take a temperature on that? Are folks going out of town for Thanksgiving, or what are we thinking of doing?
I will be here. I don't leave until November 30th, so most of November I'm okay on. And then I may not be available for most of December, and I won't be available, trying to think where all I'm going. So, and in January I'll be gone for a couple of weeks. I have an art seminar in New York, and I have a convention in Nashville, and then I'm hoping to swing through Arizona to see my daughter. So I'll be
quite the trip
in and about. So, but I think most of November I'm clear.
Okay, for the benefit of the group, we traditionally like to keep December clear because we can't foster a quorum anyway because of the holidays. So, Stephen, are you thinking you're going to be around?
I'll be around.
Okay, Rob.
I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, I'm babysitting a house and a dog in November, so I'll be here.
I'm going to come with her to the art. Yeah. No, I'll be around,
okay,
for sure.
I'll be here.
Trying to weasel out of the meetings already. Man.
Just so we can make our noticing requirements and we can still have a November meeting, we will push it to the fourth week of November, past the holiday. And that should give us plenty of time to get our notices out. We got to do a 20-dayer for that, like we typically do, to the neighbors and public utility districts. And then you can hold a hearing on it.
Looks like either, what is that, the 29th or the 30th?
Is that one?
Is it closer one?
Oh,
yeah. 29th.
29th.
I didn't even see it.
The view is different from this end of the...
So it would be the fourth Wednesday. Is that the 29th?
Yes.
I can do the 29th. I don't fly out until the 30th.
Okay. There's calendars. We can tentatively put that on.
Actually, there's five Wednesdays in November. That's the fifth Wednesday, but still, the Wednesday before that is Thanksgiving week.
Yeah. We're going to do it the week after Thanksgiving week, so the holidays done, and
29th.
Hopefully people will be available.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we will shoot for that, and that should give us plenty of time.
And then you said you're not going to schedule anything in December.
We typically, like I said, we typically don't foster a quorum. The municipal code requires us to hold a planning commission meeting every month. We have, a couple of years ago, up until last year, we were doing it as necessitated. So we want to try to, especially with the level of development and activity that's going on, we want to stay on schedule. But if we can't get a quorum, we can still have a meeting. So if we can just get a portion of you or whatnot, at the November meeting, we'll look at what your schedules look like in December.
Well, we're still working on the comp plan. We could do a workshop on that.
Yes, and those are fluid. It's a snowball, essentially, and we're going to visit that tonight, later in the meeting. That's all I have.
Okay. So, under old business, we have our finding of facts from the HAD properties. The planning department filed number 23... 2023-W006, procedural findings on that, that we need to look at and accept. So if you want to look through those on your second page.
Bids, I was absent at that meeting. I'm going to abstain from voting on that.
Madam Chair, for the benefit of the panel, this is the Dustin Jinks variance to setback requirements, the public hearing that you did at the last meeting. It was the house that they're proposing to build on the corner of Winston Section Road. Very unique shape lot. So it allows for a 6-foot reduction to the front setback, going from 15 to 9 feet, which he may not need that much. He clarified last week, but this gives him up to that.
So do I have a motion to accept the procedural findings on that file number 23-W006?
I'll make a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Angelina, did you vote on that?
So I don't know if I should because I wasn't.
So we have two recusals. That's because you weren't part of the public hearing, so probably.
All I did was read the fact. So.
We still have a quorum on that, so we're good. Okay. Got it.
Okay. Do you want me to sign this one here, or do you have one down there you want me to sign later?
I'd like you to sign
this
that
one.
I've already wrote on mine.
Okay. Today is what? What is today?
The 18th.
Thank you very much. All right, let's move on to new business and our Robert's Rules for Public Hearings.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, one of the reasons why we place this on the agenda is every year we want to make sure to do a refresher because the decisions you can make as it relates to Robert's Rules for Public Hearings can get you in hot water. We want to keep you out of hot water. And there's a lot of stuff to remember as it relates to motions and how these hearings are orchestrated and regulated. So we wanted to just go over to it particularly because we have a new Planning Commission member, although given her discipline, it's probably not going to be a hard acclimation to how these things work. So going over essentially broad strokes, there's some housekeeping items first that you should keep in mind. And I think most of you know this. Don't talk to each other. Don't do that. When you're not here, there's a way that you can create a quorum. And the whole idea of a public hearing process is that you will come here on the day of the public hearing and not be biased. You haven't had things introduced to you that creates a bias. So you're able to sit with the materials and make an unbiased decision, which, I mean, that's fair. It's fair to the property owner, it's fair to the applicant, and it's fair to the process. So that's the first thing. One thing to keep in mind is that a quorum can't just be created by virtue of three or four of you being in a group. It could also be created because you're forwarding several emails, and all of a sudden it gets forwarded to up to three or four members. Now you've created, by default, a quorum. So something, that's why we're kind of careful. I always have that nice response, by the way. Very witty response. I usually have a caveat, just reply to me, don't reply all. I can't do that with text, because when we're in a group text, there's only one. So when there's a group text, just say, okay, yeah, because usually I'm just texting you, hey, come to the meeting, we need you here, right? So so that's number one. Any questions on that? The other thing is when we're anticipating a public hearing in a meeting, you're going to get stuff from me. You're going to get a notice 20 days before the hearing. It's going to say what it is, what the date, what we're entertaining, what the zoning is, where the property is. It's going to say a plethora of information. Then 7 days prior to the hearing, you're going to get this very riveting staff report with a lot of information in it. And it has all of the code criterion here in there, and it has my particular findings on if it passes muster or not. That's the information you need to come and make a decision. So it's unbiased information. It's been seen to be that way. So one of the things by virtue of that that you can't do is you can't talk to the applicant, right? That's common sense. They're going through an application process. They're going to want, if they talk to you, they're going to want to convince you to approve it. They're going to want to sway you in their direction. You also don't want to talk to opposing property or anybody associated with it. You want to keep at arm's length everybody and keep your mind clear in that regard. And when we went through the public hearing process for the tentative approval for the RV park, we had an ex parte situation. You had an opposer reach out to you,
yeah,
which was fun, right? It was just a great conversation. So it happens. If they feel passionate enough, they feel justified, and they will reach out to you, and they will try to play on heartstrings or whatever they need to do. Well, there's no emotions in this process. It's a fact-finding process, and that's what you're making decisions on. Facts. That's it. So don't talk to applicant, property owner, opposers, even those in favor. Nobody. Just don't. You are separate. Right? So with that, let's talk. Any questions on that? Let's talk about a few things that happen in public hearings. So you don't need a motion to open a meeting, but you do need a motion to open the public hearing. Because we're declaring, we're entering into a special session to make a decision or to take in evidence and go through an evidentiary process. So after the hearing is open, we always do what's called qualify counsel. We do that too in Catholic, but we qualify the commission, right? So there's those questions you're used to hearing. Right? Did you meet as a group? Right? Has anybody have a financial interest or anything? Those have been introduced over years and years of litigation and case law, which I'm sure Angelina is acclimated to. And it's meant to disqualify you if you have a conflict of interest. You don't want to sit on the panel making decisions if you have a conflict of interest. If you have questions if there's a conflict, like for example, we recently had a plan amendment and zone change on Brantley. We had a council member that lives on Brantley. Even though she's not in the 150-foot notice area, she felt inclined to recuse herself. There may be something like that. Or, let's say there's an application being placed before the body to which you have, there's like four owners and you're one of the owners. You have to step down, right? Because you have a financial interest in it. You want it to succeed, and so therefore you're biased. We had the same application with the RV park. We had Stephen Johnson. He lived in the same area. You know, obviously felt that he couldn't make a practical decision, unbiased decision. So he did the right thing and stepped back, which was admirable.
I was way too involved with the people in the neighborhood.
Of course.
Yep.
So what is your recommendation then with ex parte contact? Should we always recuse ourselves, or do we make the decision? Do we allow you to make the decision?
Okay, so ex parte contact does not necessarily disqualify you. Ex parte just means you have to declare ex parte contact. So if someone had a very innocent conversation with you, let's say they were someone in favor or in opposition, if it's nothing that can hinder your decision making, then all you have to do is declare it for the record and we move on.
Okay.
And you stay in the decision making process and fact finding. If it's something that does violate those qualifying factors, then yeah, you'll want to step back and you'll want to declare it for the record, and you'll want to remove yourself from the decision-making process. That's it. And it'll be pretty clear. If you have a question in your mind, just ask. And we will always clarify. Because we're here to protect you and the city. That's what we do. So the public hearing process is going to require us to require you to qualify as a planning commission. Once you do that, you are stewards of the facts. We are stewards of the process. So we usher you through the process and collect the facts, and based on the evidence, you may. So We've had a few hearings in recent months. We have one very confrontational one. And we had a lot of evidence entered into the record. And it became very confusing, right? There was just so much.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. we even had some stuff come into the record where it was confusing if you should even consider it, right? So it was, the gentleman owns four other RV parks, and there was all kinds of bad press on it in other jurisdictions, right? So stuff like that. There was a traffic impact analysis that was done back in 2017, and the opposition was saying, hey, he needs to get a new one. Right? But they weren't producing their own, showing conflicts, showing traffic issues. So stuff like that, when you're going through a public hearing, you're always going to take all the evidence in, okay? You're typically not, you don't want to be in the business of turning away evidence. If they feel it's evidence, it gets entered, you take it in and consider if it's applicable, then factor it in. If it's not, then you don't. But it's in the record. It's in the file, right? So that's an important piece, because that's gotten planning commissioners into hot water before. We're not going to take that evidence. No. Take the evidence. You typically do. So once you go through the process, sometimes it gets confusing on when and how we do motions, right? You always take a motion. There's a second. You can't do those because you're the chair. There's a motion. There's a second. And then you vote. All in favor or any opposed. You have to declare those verbally. And we have to hear it for the record. It has to go on the recording. All of that is recorded. And then in terms of concluding a public hearing, one of the biggest things that we see is that once the public hearing is closed and you pass a motion to close the public hearing, the applicant and everybody, any qualified party, they can no longer speak to you. They can't anymore. The discussion is limited to the Planning Commission and staff. But what we've seen so many times is a planning commissioner or a qualified party will forget and they will ask additional questions, which is a procedural defect. It is. And the process on someone who opposes, they would oppose something, they would put in an appeal. We've seen an appeal recently. It went up to council. Council's the appellate body. They make a decision, and then they have another appeal. It could go to the Land Use Board of Appeals. That's at the state level. And only attorneys can argue at that point. If there's a procedural defect, they won't even look at the context of your application. They will say, no, you got your procedure wrong. We're kicking it down on remand. So it's very important to make sure that we shore up those procedures. I'm making this more of a gravity of the situation, but we're in it anyway. So when you close the public hearing, that's why I usually say something to the effect of, when they close the public hearing, there's no more discussion. So is there anybody else, while the public hearing is open, take your opportunity now. Yeah, you need to do that, right? So questions on that? That's how it works. I mean, those are... boilerplate.
You and I, we have not had a case go to LUBA yet, have we? Mm-hmm. And I think that since 2004, we've only had one.
Mm-hmm. The South Fork RV Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I can remember that when that came back, we didn't start over. We started it at the place kind of halfway through.
When it goes to LUBA, there's a few different options that LUBA could do. They could just say, no, we're going to affirm planning commission and council's decision at the local level. Or they could say, no, we're going to fully deny it. Or they can do the third one, which is what I've seen the most, which is remand it back to with assignments of error.
Yeah.
And at that point, you go back through the hearing process, and the only thing that you discuss is the areas of assignments of error. That's it. So, there's already a lot of ground that's been laid. And, you know, what we've seen, like, for the Molly Jacobson file,
the
South Fork RV Park, was it was remanded back, and it had assignments of error to address compatibility with the surrounding uses and traffic. Those were two very large ones. So, hey, you didn't do good enough with covering this criteria, so you need to beat this up, and then you go back through and you just only cover those. But then it has to go to planning commission, then council, and back up to.
And when that does get a case remanded up to LUBA, it does not make you friends with the city council. It does not make you friends with too many people, because it does kick it back, and it does start the process again, and it does kind of put a black mark on us. So,
well, the LUBA panel, which is a panel of three land use attorneys, they do it for a living, so they're always going to point out the necessary elements of the application that's deficient. That's their job. I've seen it more at the county, a couple of times here, and we haven't had any. I'm probably not going to want it. Right?
Yeah.
So don't want any going up the loop.
Yeah, in almost 20 years, I think we've only had one or two, and we won the one. You know, they didn't accept it, and then they accepted the other one, and we just had to make those changes.
There's one point I want to make in closing before we move on. On Robert's Rules for Public Hearing, and that is the difference between regular land use application hearings and legislative amendment hearings. There's a pretty big disparity there. And here's what it is. When you're doing a public hearing for a variance, like what we just did, or the conditional use permit for the RV park, or let's say a land partition or a subdivision, something like that, there is such a thing as ex parte contact. We do have to qualify you as a commission. You do have to declare conflicts of interest and recuse. There's all those things that are in place. With legislative amendments, those hearings are about changing city code. It's about improving things in here or changing them or updating them to meet legislation at the state level that just passed, something like that. In that regard, there's no such thing as ex parte contact. It's everybody's code. You can talk to anybody you want about it because it's a community thing, right? So you can talk to a council member. You can talk to your neighbors. You can talk to whoever at a pancake bread. It doesn't matter, right? And that's the beauty of the legislative amendments, is that the approach is a comprehensive one. So you don't have to worry about. So our script for the legislative amendments is always way more modified and condensed, because you don't have any expert, by default, you don't have any expert ticket. So wanted to make sure to clarify that, because we'll have one coming up that you'll have to make decisions on.
I have a question. So, of course, we had our first public hearing that I had to chair at. I'll thank all of you left for that later. The amount of materials coming in, we stopped the one meeting and had a continuance, came back, more stuff was entered in. Is there a time when you have to move on from them bringing in more evidence?
Good question, yeah. Thank you for that, because the continuance process had eluded me. When we open a public hearing, if someone requests verbally a continuance, you have to, by law, grant it. If they want to stall the public hearing for a date and time certain of 2 weeks from now, typically it's 7 days for the applicant, or for the rebuttal, and then 7 days for the applicant to respond. So there's usually time allotments. In terms of the process and when we keep going, can they keep... You only have to grant the initial continuance. Okay, so because it's all about new evidence being entered. So when you get into a public hearing, I think a lot of times you can take the temperature pretty quickly. There's something that comes up in terms of there's a lack of evidence. And you need to give, it's all about giving people the opportunity to enter that evidence. So for example, I'll give you a good one. That was a good hearing for you. I think that you really got your feet wet there. But let's say we would have opened that public hearing and they would have started talking about the old 2017 traffic impact analysis. It's too old, blah, blah, blah. And let's say the opposers said something like, we want to request a continuance because we want to work with our own engineer to do our own traffic study. That's an excellent reason to do a continuance, because that's new evidence that could be entered into the record. And their TIA on the opposing side, that's an engineer that's working for them, that is looking to find conflicts. with an 89-space RV park. That's something you should consider because it's empirical data. That gives some volition of what the situation is. So a continuance is about evidence, new evidence. So there are situations where you keep the record closed, but it's very rare. And there's typically not a lot of reasons why you need to do that. So the opposers, someone in favor, whomever, or even the applicant, sometimes even staff will say, we need a continuance to, we'll stall it to next month. We will give the rebuttal crowd 7 days or 10 days, and then we will give the applicant the 10 days after that, and then we'll come back to the public hearing, and all of that additional evidence will be there for you to consider with your decision. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The continuances get a little muddled, so I just wanted to make sure we...
Well, because I was very unsure when I asked about the continuance for that particular meeting. I was kind of unsure about whether we could have one or not. I hadn't thought about needing one, and so...
When we came back for the second meeting, it was very clear that there was going to be no additional evidence. Yeah. No, people were recycling the same thing, so you have every right to close the public hearing, which you did. And that was the right decision. So...
Now, once that's it, when she makes the decision to go ahead and close it, does that take away the opposition's right to contest it, or can they contest it at that point, saying no, we want to enter more evidence?
They could certainly make their case before this body, but I would strongly urge you to ask what kind of evidence they're anticipating entering. And if you feel in good conscience that it's new viable evidence that could really help with your decision making and give credence one way or the other, then allot them more time. But the whole purpose of doing an initial continuance is so that all of the additional evidence
right.
come in. Right. And so when you come back to the second hearing, you can be in a position to consider it and close the hearing and make a decision and deliberate to your decision.
Okay. Because personal opinions are not more evidence.
No.
So.
They are not.
And that's.
But.
In a very
it's a common
contentious
theme
setting,
in this
yes.
series, but yes.
Say, it's in a very contentious public
situation. What about professional people, if they hired another attorney or a engineer and they got his opinion after we, you know, and they wanted to add that in?
After the hearing was closed?
Yeah.
No, they can't. Okay. No additional evidence can come in once the hearing is closed.
Okay.
And even if the hearing's open, I would say, what kind of engineer and what are they doing a study on? Is it on traffic? Is it on noise? Is it on odor? Is it on drainage? What is it? I mean, those are the areas that you have to address.
Right.
Because they affect compatibility with the CUP criteria.
And then once the public hearing is closed and the discussion is left up to the commissioners, all of what we say does still need to be
yep.
on the record,
you
correct?
Gotta speak it loud enough that it goes into the record.
We can't be whispering to one another going, what do you think, right?
Yeah, you don't want to do that anyway, but yes, by law, you have to speak loud enough. And so the discussion after the public hearing is closed is restricted to you folks and me and staff. That's it. And all of it has to be recorded.
On the record.
At that point, before... That's the last chance we have to ask to see anything that's already been presented again, right?
After the hearing's closed, you can't ask to see anything.
No, but our final discussion, if we have a question about something, can't we ask to see that again at that time, or is it already too late?
No, during your discussion, you just can't ask anything.
No, but we can ask you to.
Yes, and we can go over any of the exhibits, any of the materials in the record, any questions you have. We can flush all those out. And you'll want to do that. You'll want to be completely clear in your mind before you make a decision. Because
okay.
that's your decision making that you do is not based on, you know, anything else other than the facts that are in the evidence that's in the record. Good questions?
May I add one thing? As Thomas explained before, the staff is here to facilitate and help you along with the process. There's nothing wrong in the process or during. if you're not sure, asking Thomas, or is this appropriate, or are we following the procedure? Is this right? It's okay to do that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, Renee before the meeting was just asking it, you know, when how motions work, and it just the mayor will be like, do we need a motion on that? He mixes nowhere. He just asks, and that's what you do. Just ask if it needs a motion.
Yeah, because I was making it clear that there are some of when I needed to ask for a motion was a little unclear to me. I got a little confused about when I needed to ask for a motion and when I didn't. So.
Yep.
Okay, is that everything for that?
It is, thank you.
So, moving on to the discussion on City of Winston legislative amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. So, just to continue on with our discussion with our legislative amendments, we're really hoping to package up a good amount in this cycle. One of the two larger areas that have made it on is we did a very prolific research project about our recreational vehicle parks. And we shared some of that in subsequent or previous meetings with you. But we're going to have to take our recreational vehicle definition and change it and introduce some transitory language in there. Transitory in the city of Winston, meaning 30 days or less. That's what we want in RV parks. What that does is that allows us to collect transient roof tax. And we're not doing it only for the taxation. That's not the only reason. We have three major RV parks in the city. And they place a lot of additional stress on our infrastructure, on our law enforcement, and on all elements of the city. And we don't collect any taxation. We can't. Because they're not seen as permanent. They're not mobile home parks. They're not. You can't count them in your census, so we don't get state revenue sharing through gas tax, any of those things. So really the only stab we can take at it to offset the detriment on our system would be to factor in some of this language and attempt to collect train. Most of our parks, if not all, are permanent. They have, as you noticed, River Bend and South Fork and Safari Umpqua, they're permanent spaces.
How would you foresee the collection of that revenue?
Well, the collection is done on the honor system, so they take currently and in most cities they take a one pager and they fill out how many spaces were 30 days or less, and they pay the percentage necessary, which I believe is, what is it, 6% on the gross?
It's 7%.
7% on the gross.
Well, we do not get any monthly payments from any RV parks for transient room.
Will that also include the ones outside the city limits that are inside the urban growth boundaries?
No, can't collect on those.
Mm. So you're only talking
can't
about...
Can't do anything in taxation in the UGB. Just in the corporate limits. So that's one area. That's one area that we are trying to address, and it's got a litany of issues and history to it. So we're doing what we can in that regard. The other thing, and thank you for meeting with me, Stephen and I met briefly. He gave me a kind of a printout. We've been doing a lot of research on the tiny home situation. Yeah, so it's a movement around the state, around the nation, really. I was watching a show where they were doing them the other day, and of course my city planner kind of mind it, like, how are you getting that permitted? That's what I, instead of, and anyway, that's typically where I'm going in my mind is how are we going to do that around here? Because, and I want to revisit this issue to make sure everyone understands it. Tiny homes are built in a manufacturing plant or in a warehouse. And they're built either two ways. They're built with an insignia on them with wheels, so therefore we have to see them as a recreational vehicle. Or they're built and put on a chassis and a foundation and skirting, and it's more or less like a mobile home. The city of Winston, we require mobile homes to be 1,000 square feet in multi-sectional, which tiny homes wouldn't pass. A lot of times they're like 400 or 500 square feet. So they're extremely deficient in that regard. So the situation arose, how do we address that in our code? Because it's not in our code. The state building code division has passed criteria for tiny homes, and it was in a lot of that language that you gave me. You can do a tiny home if XYZ, you can even have a bedroom in the loft if you put fire suppression, which is sprinkling it. There's all this criteria that goes along with it. But yeah, there's a way to get it permitted. So now the city, you, the planning commission, you're faced with, essentially there are three options that I can see. Number one, you identify properties in the city limits that are appropriate for tiny home developments, and you place an overlay on it, allowing those specific properties and only those specific properties to do so. This is not an ideal option because individual properties, even if you place overlays on them, could change, the dynamic of the property could change in subsequent years. A good example of that is the larger properties up Wood Way. There was a large lot overlay placed on those big ones in the southwest area of the city. You know, where Wood Way terminates, you go to the north, there's just all those are in city limits, and there was a large lot overlay placed down there, and now it's just irrelevant because they're residentially zoned. You're allowed to do subdivisions there. And a large lot overlay required them to stay at 50 acres. So that's a good example of an overlay that was just... But nevertheless, that's one option. The second option is you could factor it into plan unit development criteria. And a plan unit development is essentially a development where if you institute some shared area or open space, build a private little park or patios or a tennis court or something towards the community, then it gives you more units you can do in a smaller, dense area. So with apartments or with a smaller cluster subdivision, you have to do open space, and it gives you 30% more of the density, meaning instead of doing 100, it now bumps you up to being able to do 30% more than 100 units because you have this 2-acre area that you're designating as open space for that development. That's option number two. It's also development driven, so it's really not advisable in my estimation. Option number three is in any and all residential zone properties, you make it a conditionally permitted use. I mean, that's fairly straightforward. That way, it's a case-by-case basis. You look at the property that is applying for it, and you look at compatibility with the area.
Does that solve the requirements that the state has?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yep, we could defer to the building department for any kind of building inspections, but just allowing it on the property in its entirety, the conditional use permit criteria allows you to look at adjacent property uses, compatibility with adjacent uses and zoning designations. It really allows you to take it by case-by-case basis.
Now, are you telling us that these are the only choices we have available and we have to choose this, or can we do nothing?
You can do nothing, but tiny homes are...
I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm not making a choice. I'm just...
No, that's a good point. We have done nothing thus far, so, and you can continue to do nothing, but... The tiny home situation is here, and we get a level of communication from developers on how and what manner they're able to do it. And with having no language in our code whatsoever, if it's going to happen anyway, we need to have some parameters on how we're going to regulate.
If we choose option three out of that, do we have the ability to regulate density?
You can. If they're doing a tiny home village by virtue of a subdivision, it's a 6,000 square foot minimum parcel size, and they're placing a tiny home on each lot. So that it would be a subdivision, a concurrent application with a CUP for a tiny home development. If they're doing a tiny home village like a mobile home park, but they're tiny homes, and they want to do it as a CUP, then density would be irrelevant because the raw land underneath stays whole, if you will. Mm-hmm. But during the hearing process, that's a condition that you can definitely bring up.
So is this something we need to address sooner rather than later, in your view?
It's something that I think we should factor into our legislative amendments that we are crafting.
I agree. It's definitely, because it's definitely exploding everywhere. They've become starter homes for people. They've become homes for people who are downsizing in retirement. They're extremely popular. And when done right and done well, they're really quite nice. Mm-hmm. I've stayed in four now at different places, and they're awesome. And I think, you know, with the cost of housing, my son makes, you know, works above minimum wage, but he can't afford to go buy a house mm-hmm. on just his income, mm-hmm. whereas he can afford to go buy a tiny home and put that out. And so I see a lot of young people doing that, you know, or first home buyers and such. And I think it's something we really need to address, whether we have any coming down the pike right away or not. I think it's something we definitely need to get into our codes so that we're prepared for it.
Do we start this?
Well, if we think about the city, there is not ground in this city for any kind of a development of that nature that I can see any place except far west side.
Yeah, I would think it would be more like your conditional use permits as far as, like, you know, so I have an acre of land, you know, you could put one there and still be just fine. I think if we do conditional use permits for individual tiny home situations that would come up, I think would be far better than trying to worry about a tiny home park.
Yeah, the language, so we have, of course, our residential low density, medium, and high. In each of those zones, we have our permitted uses and conditionally permitted uses. We would list as an additional option in the CUP uses as a tiny home or a tiny home development, which would be comprehensive towards, you want to go to singular or you want to do a large quantity of them, then we're still going to have to look at it from a CUP standpoint. And I agree with your estimation in terms of the proximity on where the viable areas are in the city that could be conducive to development like that. The western area seems to be a little more of a viable area. But the problem is, and this is part of what we talked about, is imagine if you have a subdivision of just houses that are nice, and as you transition down the road, it transitions into a tiny home village that's not compatible. And you're going to get an uproar in a lot of the property owners because it isn't compatible, right? We have, that's why in a lot of subdivisions, there's HOAs saying you can't do mobile homes. And you know, these tiny homes are probably going to fall in that, under that umbrella. So in my recommendation, the CUP option is by far and away your best one.
Well, maybe we need to hold a, after the first of the year and we've got more time, maybe we need to hold a, like a Saturday workshop and draft something up to where we can work the kinks out in one day and maybe present something to the city council that way. Just get it done and over with.
Well, the legislative amendments for the code changes would have to go through fully through the hearing process.
Right,
we would have to
right.
do a public hearing with, we couldn't do it in a workshop session. We have to do a public hearing with you folks, and we have to do notifications to the state and go through the whole, like we did with the HNA.
Right, but we couldn't have a workshop beforehand to, so everybody can get their own ideas in and we can say, get everything worked out and then present it at a public hearing?
Basically get the language down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying is just...
That's how we would want it to evolve.
Yeah.
But what we want to make sure, because we only have really two areas... We want to make sure that we're doing this in concert with our economic opportunities analysis. We want that to be part of our packet. And so it's okay if we take our time with this. I mean, it is, to make sure that we have a comprehensive packet.
Where does this fall in line? Remember, was it a year or 2 years ago when the state told us that we can take agricultural land and change the designation to residential? Where does this fall into using agricultural land? Would that be a PUC also, or?
No, so what that was is, that was in concert with our housing needs analysis.
Right.
Because all of the ag open zone land in the city was being factored in as usable area. And as you know, we got them to delete that out because it's one dwelling unit per 10 acres.
Yeah.
And so, no, that's kind of a separate issue. If we were to, they didn't necessarily say it would go to residential. They just said we need to do an analysis to figure out what kind of deficiency or surplus we have in all of our designations.
Okay.
To figure out logistically what it should be planned if we were going to transition those. It would have to be all of the AO. But what we found is a lot of the AO properties are encumbered by natural features anyway.
Right.
By the floodplain or floodway or geohazard, a significant incline of 12% or more. I mean, that's a lot of what it was. So we elected to table that, if I can recall.
I thought the city mandated, or the state had mandated something to the cities to adopt it in or something.
Nope, you have full regulatory power over your zoning in
okay.
the city. The state hasn't said anything to that effect. Although it is very rare to have an ag designation in an incorporated city. It's essentially a holding zone. It's irrelevant.
Well, it was done during the housing needs analysis, and you said something to the effect that the state was trying to allow for more multi-dwelling property or multi-dwelling units on a property. So they were taking that ag zone properties and allowing them to put an apartment building or something on it because the housing needs was so high at the time.
Okay, so that's legislation that passed 2 years ago. It was a House bill that ratified in both houses that requires a population 5,000 or more to require an accessory dwelling unit in any residential zone properties, not having anything to do with the AO zoning.
I could have sworn
which we adopted as part of our last session.
Mm-hmm. I could swear there was something with the AO that the state sent down to where the city could adopt in allowing multi-dwelling structures on AO property. If the need was there.
I don't even think the state knows we have AO zoning properties.
Well, yeah.
So the most recent legislation as part of our packet makes ADUs irrelevant or accessory dwelling units because they have now went full-fledged into if you're 5,000 or more and there's a property that has a house, you're required to allow them to have a duplex, which essentially makes it all low density medium.
Yeah.
So we have to factor that into our, and that got ratified in both, and that runs in concert with the housing shortage.
Right.
What it doesn't do is factor in the additional stress on our storm that wasn't calculated, or our sewer, or water services, or any of those things, or drainage runoff, none of that stuff, but that's a issue for another day. So are we forgetting anything that we need to? The point of this exercise is to have a running total and start collecting different things that can help all. One of the other things that came up is 600 square feet for an accessory structure viable? Is that big enough? Thoughts on that?
Well, 600.
A shop, a detached garage, a carport, something that's detached from the house. It's allowed to be 600 square feet and no more. As of now.
Yeah, which would be about half the size of this room.
So
maybe less than that.
Two-car garage is 400.
400?
So,
okay.
Yeah, 600 square feet. So I think
okay.
It'll be a little bigger.
So it's about this size.
So, yeah, you're going to have a three-car garage, essentially.
Yeah.
Something
which
to
is quite
kick
a
around.
Floor space.
So 600 is the maximum? Okay.
Yep.
Well, a 600 square foot unit is not going to be something you're going to move around the whole block. How would you put 600 square feet on wheels?
Well, no, this is relating to a accessory structure. So
yeah.
Like a garage or a,
okay.
It's the maximum square footage for
so
an accessory.
So that'd be a stick built house.
What's that?
That'd be a stick built place or?
No, no house at all. Just accessory structure.
Just a structure.
Shops, sheds.
Mm-hmm. So this is a residential amenity.
So those are things we have to look at to put in with this, then?
Well, no, that's already allowed. It's just the maximum is 600 square feet. The question is that big enough, or do you want to allow more? Do you want to go up to 7? So Myrtle Creek allows 400. So they cap it at 4. And we used to cap it at 4. We raised it 3 or 4 years ago to 6. So the only reason it comes up is we've had several property owners just say, why are you keeping us to that? We got a bunch of them around the city that, well, they're pre-existing. They were built a long time ago, right? So,
Are you referring to the quote-unquote mother-in-law cottage type things?
No, shops.
Okay.
Shops.
Because we limited the mother-in-law cottage to 900 square feet or 600?
The accessory dwelling units are limited to 75% of the gross floor area of the main house, or 1,000 square feet, whichever it is.
Okay, 1,000 square feet, that's what it was. Yeah.
So that's another one to think about. We're just kind of going through and spitballing different ways that we can increase or augment the code. The code is your vision as planning commission members. You represent the city's interests, so it's kind of what you prescribe.
I kind of think if you're going over 600 square feet, that would have to be kind of on an individual basis, wouldn't it? Because it would depend a lot on your neighbors. And I mean, are you a large property that has room for a 1,000 square foot barn?
Okay.
Or are, you know what I mean?
So we could make, that's an excellent point. We could make, as a CUP use, accessory structures that exceed 600 square feet. We could make that an additional conditional use, permitted use, if you're so inclined to go that direction.
For our community, I think it would be better on a case-by-case basis instead of making one general rule, because, you know, some people are going to be a square property and some are going to have a triangular property in this town, and some are going to have 6 or 8,000 square feet and some are going to have 5,000, so it's going to have to be looked at. The generalities are going to have to be taken out of it, I think, on this one.
Yeah, I think anything over 600 feet would need to be on an individual basis.
Sure. No, that's an excellent point there. You can review it on a case-by-case basis through the hearing process and look at what the compatibility is and all of those elements. So that's something that we can...
Well, isn't that the main purpose of this body anyway? To look at things like that on a case-by-case basis?
Through a CUP use, yes. That would be the purpose there. So the other thing I wanted to share, and this isn't related to our legislative amendments, is we did receive confirmation that we have the monies for our floodplain grant to look at Looking Glass. So
cool.
That I think we have a value of, it could be 80, could be 90,000, but there's a lot of engineering work that has to go into that. So that's a state permit, grant. Turned out to be a good deal. They're going to have to come down and set up shop by the river and evaluate the whole thing, lay down all kinds. I mean, it's a study. It's quite a comprehensive study. And then at the end, we will have to do a letter of map revision for the city through FEMA to adopt in that part of Looking Glass what the floodplain looks like. FEMA will have to acknowledge it, which they will.
So basically, we'll be going from each green bridge to the green bridge, right?
No. This is, so if you're looking at Looking Glass Creek where it comes up, right about here over, our data drops off. So this stretch here.
Oh, okay.
Our data drops off. We don't know what's floodplain. We don't know what's floodway. We just know that they're in there somewhere. We just have this. And go on our website sometime, because the floodplain, if you bring the floodplain up, the floodplain is blue. The floodway is red. Red meaning this is high flow frequency. But once you get right out to here, it just changes to this weird, bland green color where it's like, nope, nothing more. We don't know.
So this will clarify what's there.
So what is that about Civil Bend Road then, west?
That would be Abraham, north of Abraham. And
north? Okay, Abraham.
It's
okay.
Just to the west of the RV park property.
Okay. Yeah, the grant covers the creek all the way out to Brockhurst?
It covers the creek all the way out to where our city limit line terminates, to the
city
west.
City limit line.
Which would be right around there.
Right around Brockway.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
So I think that's moving forward. We're getting a meeting together on that in short order. That's all I have.
Okay, do we have any other business tonight?
Do you want to talk more about what we talked about before the meeting started, or is it something we can bring up and maybe see if it's something we want to schedule after the first of the year?
Yeah. I can't remember what we talked about.
Not limiting or automotive repair shops and dealerships, that kind of stuff in the city, in the commercial areas.
Okay, so it's common for small communities, especially planning commission bodies, to look at the town and feel that we have too many of one type of operation. For example, auto body shops, car sales lots, things like that. So then the regulatory bodies, such as yourself, kind of get a little bit in the business of, well, what can we do about it? And the recommendation from staff, what I can tell you is that the property is zoned a specific way, and the zoning allows specific uses. And once we start getting in the business of trying to further regulate those, then it really tends to be a frivolous attempt, because the commercial operations a lot of times are cyclical, right? They go in a cycle, and there may be a different, instead of a car lot, there may be a different operation there 10 years from now. What we could do is, again, we could entertain the CUP options for those types of designations, but then you're going to place yourself in a situation where you're biased in a public hearing just because we have five of them and you don't want any more. Right? So it's in the best interest of government, such as yourself, not to be in the business of picking and choosing in that regard, would be my recommendation. That's probably not helpful, but...
Well, I was just curious because I did take a count, and you can literally walk down any town and count every third business as either car parts, car sales, car repair, you know, and it's on the corner, it's on Cheetah Corner, you know, there's a car lot, car repair there. It seems like every business just about, or every other business, has something to do with car repairs, car sales, and, you know, let's quit giving up our business property to that and give it to retail sales or something.
But I do know a few years ago, it all seemed to be secondhand shops.
Yeah.
You know, so we have cycled, like you were talking about, it does kind of become cyclical in that, you know, businesses change out. It is frustrating to sometimes see the same three kinds of businesses in a small town, and you're like, but if we could just have something different. But I can see where it could lead to a lot of issues, because this automotive guy is going to go, well, why can't I have my shop? He has his shop, and we're the same thing. So I get that, you know, it would be next to impossible to regulate any of that.
Look at Mark and Niemeyer, and regulations like that didn't go so well.
I'm just trying to cause trouble.
Well, how do they regulate something like the cannabis shop?
Here?
England.
It's used, the permitting is done through OLCC, the Oregon Liquor
Commission. So there's an extra step.
There's a state permit, but...
a city can say no cannabis shops.
Well, we do. We say no recreational. We do allow medical.
Well, I mean, they can do that. Why can't they do it with something else?
Well, I mean, so Measure 91 allowed cities to put a moratorium on it. There was a allowance in the measure from a statutory requirement. If we're talking about a general commercial use that is any number of normal businesses, then that doesn't fall under a measure allowance. So there's a different animal.
Yeah, there. Extra. That's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Wasn't that something like with the recreational marijuana? Wasn't that something that actually had to go on a ballot and be voted on by the community itself, whether we would have them in or not?
We did a couple of years ago. We put it on the ballot, and we had a separate ballot measure to collect the taxation. The tax one passed, but the recreational marijuana, if we don't allow the rec, then we can't collect the taxation, right? So the tax one got codified. The city has voted on it twice, and the city of Winston doesn't.
Well, it's when we put in there 1,000 feet from the nearest school.
Yeah, where are you going to go?
you can't go anywhere in Winston 1,000 feet from the school. I mean, therefore, cut them out, basically.
If recreational marijuana is voted again, we would match the state provisions on buffer zones, on daycares, on schools, on which is significantly decreased, but still sufficient. The marijuana situation is an outlier. We're not talking about your normal bucket of commercial uses that are typically free reign if it's allowed in the general commercial zone or the historical commercial zone. Or
Go ahead.
I was thinking more of, instead of restricting, maybe encouraging certain businesses, if we can put something in that of, instead of restricting, to bring them here.
Yeah, which we've been trying to traditionally do with our URA program, our Urban Renewal District program, and that's an excellent point. The encouragement does need to be there. I would say if you're looking at anything for the commercial district, we should look at a design review to enhance aesthetics. That's going to bring more commercial operations in there, more dynamic. So I think that would probably have the desired effect. Our URA program will have to be re-entertained in a couple of years. So that's one area that we can look at that may have additional funding. But I see where you're coming from. I think there's a really good intent, but I think once we get into that, it gets a little sticky in terms of the allowances there. That's a good point. Thank you. Did you have something
to add? I was just going to ask about EPA stuff with car repairs. I manage a motorcycle shop, and they can sit right on the fence like a vulture and just stare at you if they want to.
There's typically no EPA. I think that's a federal jurisdiction, isn't it?
Well, that's what I mean. If you're changing oil, they just want to know. And so if you're right here in the middle of town next to a restaurant, you're dumping oil on the ground. You know what I'm saying? If it's specifically to car repair stuff.
Yeah, the automobile service shops all would have required a public hearing and conditions of approval that spoke towards a grease and oil trap and a state permit from DEQ or the Department of Environmental Quality, which usually covers contamination, ground saturation, those types of things. Usually a surfacing to catch it. That's what we did on BNS. We went through a full CUP process, and I think Rob, you were the only one in on that still. That was a colorful one.
Yeah, to say the least.
EPA, in my experience, has never been required to be involved as a federal agency.
Well, I say that the shop that I was managing, the lot next to it, had been a gas station back in the 40s and 50s, and the people that owned it could never sell that. They still can't sell that land. Because it's $500,000 to clean up a $100,000 lot. So they can really work some tricks on you if they want to.
Well, I'm coming up on 20 years on the Planning Commission, and every time we've worked with either DEQ or the EPA, we've came out on the short end of the stick. I know it's a cliche, but you can't fight big government. And they're always going to win.
I'm talking about using them as a tool, not fighting.
Well,
using their regulations.
I guess, but that's kind of like using a lit stick of dynamite.
Before this gets too political,
I'm sorry. Go right ahead. I was just about to quiet the boys.
I did have one other question about, I haven't fully looked at the code yet, and I don't know how much of a problem this is, but have you guys passed anything about Airbnb's long-term over 30 days stay that they have to start paying tax?
No.
Okay. I know that that was something that was passed up in Boston, where either they said you cannot rent an Airbnb out for more than 30 days, and if you do, then they have to start paying tax. So I don't know if that's...
Didn't the state just pass a law about that, like 6 months ago?
I wasn't here 6 months
something.
Ago.
Yeah,
I remember something about...
Yeah.
So Airbnb, if you want to list it on their website, if you want to be associated with the Airbnb, like you go on the app, you go on the website, and you look at what... Their operation collects right off the top transient room tax. So we do collect some. It gets sent to us directly, even though we have no language in our code regulating. But that's an excellent point. If you look at the VRBOs or the Airbnbs, it's happening in the city. We should at least have corresponding language to give full volition to it. But we do get monies. I mean,
yeah.
You know, because they collect it and they know that we're, you know, if it's transient, it's less than 30 days and they're renting rooms out or they're renting their house out or they're doing something for a couple of days at a time, which qualifies. It's under 30 days.
You know, then maybe we should write up some language, you know, Ben's, we're getting money for it anyway. We need to have something.
Because I was also thinking with like the tiny houses that kind of can go hand in hand too, if they're going to make a development. Is it going to be... like all Airbnbs, or is it going to be actual houses for like long term?
Because most of the ones I've stayed in have actually been a mix of those who come and go, Airbnbs, and permanent structure of the tiny homes. A lot of them have been a mix of those options. So,
with those options, can we as a body designate those conditions? Where they have to choose, are you going to use it for a permanent home? Are you going to use it for a B&B? Can we make them designate what it's going to be used for, or do we not have that right?
It's their decision if they're going to do it permanent or temporary. That is their decision. But you can place conditions upon, if they do use it temporary, what they have to do in order to do that. So the conditions have to be written around what they're proposing. They're going to dictate what they're proposing.
So we can't write up the conditions beforehand and say, okay, here's your choices. We can't.
The choices are already in the code.
Right.
They're there.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Is there any other business tonight? No? Then do I have a motion?
And a motion to adjourn.
A motion for adjournment.
So moved. So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you all for coming.
See, next time you can be more boisterous. Just jump in.
Yeah. We just talk over one another. We stop trying to.